chance to bring their interests into the rooms with me if I could only figure out a way to get the people with influence to care about them. So when Kathleen told me that she had been going to dinners with other women doing amazing things and invited me to join them, I instantly said yes. On the night of the dinner, I was running late. My last two patients of the day had needed a little extra time. And as I was circling Kathleen's block, looking for parking after making the 45-minute drive across town from Bayview, I was struck by the sense that I might have been in the same city, but it was a totally different world. Finally, I found a spot that I hoped wasn't blocking Danielle Steele's driveway. Kathleen's house wasn't the biggest on the block, but it was still pretty impressive. I stepped through the door and into the living room, where everyone was sipping wine or sparkling water and taking in the spectacular view of the bay and Alcatraz that can be seen only from this part of town. Clearly, I was the last to arrive, but no one seemed at all annoyed. Kathleen eventually ushered us into the dining room to take our seats. Introductions were made all around, and it was immediately apparent that these women were all jaw-droppingly accomplished. One woman was an angel investor, and another had worked for the State Department before starting her own international consulting firm with none other than former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates. And this being San Francisco, there were also a couple of successful tech entrepreneurs, plus a few women who, like myself, were trying to change the world by starting nonprofits. Prior to the dinner, Kathleen had circulated a feature article on one of the guests, Caroline, that had just run in Time magazine. Oh, and there was the minor fact that every single one of them was seriously cover of Vogue gorgeous. There was just one woman other than me whose hair was not some shade of blonde. It was the kind of crowd you could easily love to hate. They just seemed too perfect. But the minute we started talking, it became obvious that I hadn't signed up for dinner with the Stepford wives. These women were trailblazers, and they had the battle scars to prove it. We discussed the challenges of running an organization and getting funding. We commiserated about how difficult it could be to raise the next round for an idea you believe in deeply. We laughed, we shouted, we talked over one another, we pounded the table. We all shared life hacks, little tips on how to be CEOs and international leaders and high-powered attorneys and still be good mothers and good wives and not lose our freaking minds. At the end of the night, there were hugs and lingering conversations. Much to my delight, the dinners became a regular thing. The location and the agenda was charged to a different woman each time. When it was my turn to host a few months later, I was excited to put the brain trust on a case. For the most part, things at work were going well. I had just done a TED Talk that, while terrifying, had been a big success. It allowed us at CYW to build the awareness and support we needed to expand our efforts. I had been traveling the country, going everywhere from the Mayo Clinic to Johns Hopkins, talking about toxic stress and the need to screen for ACEs. While the message was clearly hitting home, I continued to see one particularly vexing issue. Media reports invariably presented toxic stress as if it happened only in poor neighborhoods. I had set up a Google alert for toxic stress, and the title of every article I received contained some version of the toxic stress of poverty. It was driving me crazy. While I knew all too well that poor communities experience higher doses of adversity, and had fewer resources to deal with it. I was worried that the issue was being framed as a poor people problem or a black and brown problem. I repeatedly called out Dr. Felitti's demographic, 70% college educated and 70% Caucasian. But that was not the thing people took away. On the night of the dinner at our house, my husband, Arno, helped me cook a gorgeous meal. In this case, helped means that I chopped things precisely the way he told me to, while he put it all together into something resembling a Bon Appetit magazine cover. While he whipped and whisked, I told him my plan. I was going to share my frustration with the group and see if they had any ideas. There was a cold tomato and cucumber soup, a perfectly roasted chicken, and a late summer salad. As the Pinot Noir began to flow, I laid out my problem to the group. I told them that we were getting traction with spreading the message, but it seemed as if the world was missing the point, that toxic stress is about basic human biology, and that adversity happens everywhere, among all races and geographic areas. I shared my fear that if this became a poor people of color issue, we would miss an opportunity to help all children. I asked how they thought I could get my colleagues to understand that it was important to screen everyone for ACEs, not just people in low income or vulnerable communities. For a handful of seconds, everyone was silent. But before I could worry that they had no idea what I was talking about, or worse, that something had gone terribly wrong with the soup, they all started talking at once. I had put the question out to a bunch of women rock stars, but they answered as mothers, wives, and daughters. Kara, the angel investor, jumped in. "I think that the problem is that it's just so behind the scenes in other communities. I mean, my dad was an alcoholic, and it was really brutal. But he could hold down a job, so no one knew." Heads nodded. As the conversation popcorned around the table, fully half of the 10 women shared their own experiences of some significant ACEs. Much of it was very similar to what I heard from my patients in Bayview: parental mental illness or addiction, sexual assault, physical and emotional abuse, domestic violence. But what struck me was how hidden it had been. Looking at these women, at what they had accomplished, at the lives that they had built for themselves, no one would have guessed that half of them had experienced some pretty major adversity as kids. Ultimately, Kara piped back up. "I guess the big question is, what can you do if you know you have an ACE score? I mean, is knowing really going to make a difference?" I was about to launch into my standard response, but before I could, I heard Caroline let out a sigh and put down her spoon. Even more than her Scandinavian supermodel looks, Caroline's bearing is what I find remarkable about her. She may be the most analytical person I have ever met. Her brain is like a computer. No matter what the question is, when Caroline responds, you get the sense that she has calculated all of the options and is responding with a solution that has at least a 99.4% likelihood of success. Yet suddenly, something in her face, in her very demeanor, changed. Everyone looked her way. "Oh, you guys," she said, shaking her head. "It makes all the difference in the world." While the salad was served, Caroline told us her story. She had met her husband while she was in graduate school at Stanford. Both artsy and mathy in equal measure, she had degrees in art and computer science and was totally fascinated by the symbiosis of man and machine. Naturally, She fit right in with the scores of people whose life work in the 1990s was finding patterns in the huge data sets being generated by this new thing called the internet. It seemed obvious to Caroline that a visual tool was needed. So she spearheaded the development of a software that helped researchers visualize information in a way that allowed them to more easily compare trends and data. The software was a huge success and launched Caroline's career. So she dropped out of Stanford and started a company to develop and license the software. It was through that work that she met a man named Nick, who was tall, handsome, and super intense. Caroline was drawn to Nick's passion for politics and science, and loved how he could wax philosophical for hours about what he saw as the inevitable future in which artificial intelligence saves the world. Things moved quickly, and within a few months, they were living together. Soon they were married, and for the most part, it was wonderful. But after a few years, Caroline felt that something was off. Something didn't feel quite right. But she couldn't put her finger on it. So when she found out she was pregnant, that first moment of realization wasn't what Caroline had always imagined it would be. She didn't squeal and rush to tell Nick. In fact, she thought about not telling him at all. She even considered leaving before her pregnancy began to show, breaking it off with Nick and moving out. This urge felt like both a betrayal and somehow the right thing to do. Still in her 20s, Caroline had started a company and was on the way to some serious success. This is where her life was. And besides, she did love Nick. When things were great, they were really great. It just didn't feel like things had been that great lately. When Caroline told Nick about the baby, he was sweet and excited. During her pregnancy, he would rub her belly as they lay in bed and say, "Just imagine a little boy for me to build robots with." He helped her lever her enormous belly out of chairs and brought her water to make sure she stayed hydrated. But after Carl was born, things changed. Nick quickly became frustrated that Caroline was giving all her energy and attention to the baby. As most moms know, a newborn is a giant well of need at the center of your world. Everything else comes second, third, or not at all. Caroline understood that this change of regime had to be hard for her husband. He'd been dethroned pretty rapidly. Gone were the days of her tousling his hair as she walked by the couch on her way to whip up some dinner. Instead, she felt frazzled and overwhelmed. And more often than she cared to admit, it just seemed like he was getting in her way, making her mom job harder than it needed to be. Soon, the smallest things became epic arguments. Nick's drinking escalated pretty dramatically after the baby was born. He had always been a partier. But after Carl arrived, things went off a cliff. Soon he was having issues at work and was fired from a string of jobs. As the months went by, it seemed to Caroline that she spent more time figuring out how to avoid fights with Nick than enjoying his company. Everything set him off. He refused to help take care of Carl, so when she went back to work, they got a full-time nanny. He resented when Caroline talked on the phone with her dad, and when she finally found a moment to get out of the house and have lunch with a girlfriend, Nick was furious. Despite how angry he constantly was with her, Nick didn't want Caroline to be very far from him. At first, he just moped when she spent solo time with friends and family. But it wasn't long before he was giving her ultimatums. "It's them or me." Eventually, Caroline decided it was easier to avoid the drama altogether and just stay home and watch TV with Nick. He seemed, at least, a little happier that way. She found herself making excuses to her girlfriends for why she couldn't go out. One evening, when Carl was about 6 months old, Caroline and Nick were in the kitchen making dinner when something happened that set him off. Like a discarded cigarette igniting a wildfire, it was a small transgression with big consequences. Years later, she wouldn't even remember what it was, but she would never forget the sound of Nick screaming at the top of his lungs, slamming cabinet doors. Caroline shrank into silence. She knew better than to argue. And for about 30 seconds after he stopped yelling, the entire kitchen was quiet. Then from the breakfast nook, Carl let out a wail. When Caroline looked at her son, his face was beet red, and he was letting out the shrieking, gasping cries that rips at any mother's heart. Still frozen, Caroline thought to herself that she had never heard that particular cry from him before. Just then the nanny swooped in, scooped Carl up, and took him into the other room. Caroline wondered how the hell she had gotten to this place. On the surface, things appeared to be going well. Her company had been acquired, and she had joined the leadership team of one of the biggest firms in Silicon Valley. But at home, things were awful. The sound of the garage door opening, announcing Nick's arrival, would set her heart pounding. And when she heard his keys jangling at the front door, she would brace herself for what might be coming next. She was a smart woman. After all, she was managing hundreds of engineers and computer scientists every day. She knew there had to be a way for her to manage this situation. She just hadn't figured it out yet. In the rare moments of connection and tenderness with Nick, she would gently ask him why they fought so much. This can't be normal, can it? He had one of two reactions whenever she brought up the possibility that something was wrong. When a bad mood was barely below the surface, he would go off on a diatribe about how all her friends were against him. He'd say they were just jealous because he and Caroline loved each other so much while their own marriages were boring and passionless. If he was feeling playful, he would tease her about being a typical woman. He'd compliment her, saying she was too smart to get caught up in some romantic comedy-induced delusion of the perfect relationship. He'd call her babe and say, this was just the way love worked in the real world. You laughed and you screamed sometimes. Either way, you knew the other person loved you, so you gutted it out. Shortly after Carl turned 3, the family moved from the center of town to a new home, a big house that was as secluded as it was beautiful. The live-in nanny who had been taking care of Carl since he was born was unable to come with them. Up until that point, Carl had been a confident, happy kid. He would run up to strangers on the street and exuberantly shout, "Hi, I'm Carl!" After the move, Caroline noticed that he became withdrawn and shy. Soon, they were getting calls from his nursery school. His teachers complained that he had started hitting other kids in his class. By his 4th birthday, the school had had enough. They insisted that Caroline and Nick take Carl to be evaluated for ADHD. Caroline was worried. In addition to his short fuse at school, she noticed that Carl had become quick to cry and tantrum at home. More concerning, he was suddenly getting sick all the time. He had always been a healthy kid. She had breastfed forever. But lately, he constantly had a cold or a tummy ache or a headache. She wondered if the new house was too damp. They were referred by their pediatrician to a top clinic for ADHD assessment, where Carl was seen by a seasoned clinician. He evaluated Carl and his parents together, and then spent some time with Carl alone. While the four-year-old played tentatively with one of the medical assistants nearby, the doctor told Caroline and Nick what he had observed. "Look, this is going to be hard to hear, but your child is lacking the protections of childhood," he said. "What does that mean?" Caroline asked. "He's being exposed to psychological trauma. He needs a more peaceful, less stressful environment. We believe that is what's contributing to his ADHD. For Caroline, the part of the conversation that would haunt her later was also the part Nick was unable to accept. Exposed to psychological trauma. That's what the doctor had said. But Nick ignored everything but the term ADHD. And while he was great about making sure Carl got his Ritalin, he told her the rest of what the doctor said was bullshit. While some of Carl's teachers were happy that his behavior was more manageable, Caroline was disturbed that her son seemed to be totally zombified. Gone was her spirited, willful child, and instead, here was a glassy-eyed kid who couldn't eat because the medicine gave him stomach problems. They tried a couple of different medications, finally ending up with Adderall, but Carl still hated the way it made him feel. In school, he was calmer, but Caroline worried that he wasn't learning. When Caroline started having what she thought were panic attacks in the middle of the night, she began to wonder if maybe she was the problem. Maybe this sleepless, heart-pounding thing wasn't about Nick or their relationship. Maybe it was just her. Was she working too much? Did she have some kind of condition? She didn't know, but she knew she needed to fix it. So she went to therapy to try and figure it out. The doctor she saw prescribed exercise and time to herself.
"Yeah, right," she laughed.
By this time, she was running one company and consulting for another. But the doctor was serious, telling her to book Caroline time into her schedule, just like she would a marketing meeting. He said that she'd be accountable to him for that time. He would check in with her about whether or not she had kept the meeting with herself. For a while she tried, dutifully putting it on her calendar, but it didn't work. She'd hijack the time, use it to finish that one project that simply couldn't wait. This went on for months before her boss finally intervened. "Why don't you use my personal trainer?" he suggested. "I insist." When she saw her boss's face, it dawned on her that perhaps she hadn't been hiding her personal stress as well as she had thought. Caroline knew enough to accept his offer. With her boss's support, Caroline found that it was easier than she had anticipated to squeeze some yoga into her schedule between meetings. Somewhere between tree pose and downward facing dog, she began to feel her stress slowly lifting in waves. For a while, she woke up less and less in the middle of the night. But it wasn't long before her me time became an issue for Nick, sparking an epic fight about her selfishness. It didn't matter to him that she was busting her butt as a sole breadwinner for the family. He thought she should spend less time working and more time with Carl and him, and that she definitely, definitely not be taking time away from the family just so she could try to look good. He began publicly posting his opinions about her online. Caroline felt like a fly stuck in amber. Nothing she said or did could get Nick to change his behavior. She knew that his rage was terribly harmful for Carl. But she told herself that, after all, Nick had never hit Carl, or her for that matter. She resolved to make sure that Carl would never be alone in Nick's care. Divorce meant shared custody, and she was panicked at the thought of not being there when Carl spent time with his father. What if he got drunk and drove with Carl? What if he flew off the handle and screamed at him? As miserable as she felt, it wasn't about her. Caroline needed to be there for her son, so she would stick it out, come hell or high water. So nothing changed. And maybe it wouldn't have if it hadn't been for the unimaginable courage of her 7-year-old son. One day, during a typical blowout, instead of retreating into his bedroom like he usually did when his parents fought, Carl stood in the doorway and watched as his dad berated his mom. When it was over and his father had left, Carl went to his mother and took her face in his hands. "Mom," he said, looking her straight in the eye, "we have to leave." 2 years later, Caroline sat in a darkened room with 6 other women watching a video. They were all strangers to her, other moms who had also filed restraining orders, other women who she imagined were just as surprised as she was to see themselves reflected in a low-budget, court-mandated video. But the video wasn't about the women. It was about their children. A couple argues in a bedroom upstairs while a little girl stares blankly at a TV. A little boy is non-responsive when a teacher asks him questions at school. Another boy lashes out at his sister, hitting her just like he's seen his dad hit his mom. Caroline remembered thinking as she watched that the video's message was what you would expect. Witnessing physical violence is obviously bad for kids. Everybody knew that. But what made her sit on the edge of her seat and her hands go numb was what the video had to say about verbal and emotional abuse. It was just as bad for kids, and in some ways, worse. The video showed kids with symptoms just like Carl's. But it was when they showed a baby starting to cry as his parents argued that Caroline remembered Carl wailing in his high chair. She began to weep. Years later, at my dining room table, Caroline's tears were gone, but her astonishment wasn't. 15 years I lived like that, she said, shaking her head. And I thought it was normal. I blamed myself. I thought something was wrong with me all those years. I wish someone had shown me that video when I was in high school. As Caroline wrapped up her story, faces around the table revealed a mix of empathy, solidarity, and utter disbelief. Despite the fact that many of the women at dinner that night had known Caroline for years, none of them had heard that story before. She told us that it wasn't until her lawyer actually said it that she ever contemplated that what had happened could be considered emotional abuse. The yelling, the intimidation, the controlling behavior. All of a sudden, she could see it for what it was. "How's Carl doing now?" Kathleen asked. "So much better," replied Caroline. She told us that not long after they moved out, she began to see a change. Carl wasn't so quick to get upset, and he just seemed calmer in general. She took him back to the psychologist, and she and Carl were now in therapy, both together and separately. But ironically, the things that seemed to make the biggest difference for Carl were the changes she made for herself. Caroline created more time for her son and herself. She rediscovered her love of drawing and painting and ballet. She found herself able to slow down and open up. She described feeling calmer and gentler. Carl completely fed off his mother's energy. Together, they took up rock climbing and began doing yoga poses in the living room of their new apartment. Eventually, they decided he should stop the medication for ADHD. Initially, when Carl went off the medication, some of his problem behaviors returned. He was very reactive and would get upset quickly. Caroline spent time helping his teachers understand how to work with him. They made sure that he was actually writing things down, that he switched his attention from one task to the next intentionally, and then came back to the original point. For years, he had missed out on learning those basic skills because he was so subdued. From then on, when the challenging behaviors came back, Caroline, his teachers, and his therapist were able to address them in partnership successfully. "Honestly, it sounds like Carl was experiencing toxic stress," I said. "It makes perfect sense that he did so much better, because exactly what you did is the treatment for toxic stress. Number one, reduce the dose of adversity. Number two, strengthen the ability of the caregiver to be a healthy buffer. Your getting healthy was actually an incredibly important part of the equation. It's like when a flight attendant tells you to put your own oxygen mask on before putting it on your child. That's no joke. Your stress response was dysregulated, which made it impossible to help him regulate his. That's the mechanism that's so critical to understand. You getting out and taking care of yourself wasn't selfish. It was exactly the right thing to do for Carl." Caroline nodded. "I've noticed that the more I do for myself, the better he copes with things. It's crazy how resilient kids can be when they have a strong buffer," I said. "It's true. Now when he has supervised visits with his dad, he'll come back and something will have happened to bother him, right? He might have a shorter fuse for a couple days, but after a few more days of just doing our usual thing, he's back on track. I just wish I had known that earlier," Caroline said, shaking her head. "I would have gotten out a lot sooner. I see it in my patients every day, and girl, it's rough." "I'm so sorry you had to go through that," I said. "Situations like yours are exactly why we need to do screening for everyone. Because most pediatricians, if they saw you, Miss Gorgeous Time Magazine, roll into their exam room, they wouldn't ask about potential adversity at home. They might be afraid of offending you, or assume that because you're so well put together, nothing like that could possibly be happening in your home. But if screening is a part of a protocol they do as a matter of course, they'll be able to identify what's going on. Janet, a dynamo who runs a successful online retailing business, chimed in from the other side of the table. "Okay, can we get real here for a minute? It's obvious why screening every child is a must. But what do you do if you're an adult and you had ACEs as a kid? Is there treatment for that? Honestly, I'm thinking about my husband Josh right now." "Absolutely," I said. "It's never too late to start rewiring your stress response. The impact of interventions for toxic stress may not be quite as dramatic in adults as it is in our kids, but it can still make a big difference. This might sound simple, but I cannot overstate this. The single most important thing is recognizing what the problem is in the first place." I shared with them my observation that many people with overactive stress responses don't know what's happening in their bodies, so they spend all this time chasing down the symptoms instead of getting to the source of the problem. Once folks understand what's going on, they've taken the first step towards healing. I went on to explain that for toxic stress, the six things that I recommend for my patients, sleep, exercise, nutrition, mindfulness, mental health, and healthy relationships, were just as important for adults. Checking in on how you're doing in those six areas and talking to your doctor is a good place to start. If necessary, you can request a referral to a sleep specialist, a nutritionist, or a mental health provider. The other important piece I mentioned was that adults with high ACEs were at increased risk of health problems, which was why it was important for them to ask their doctors if they had heard of the ACE study. A doctor can help you understand how your ACE score and your own family history affect your risk for certain illnesses, and then the two of you can work together to create a plan for prevention and early detection. The great news is that there's now a field called integrative medicine that is dedicated to looking at the whole person and using the latest science to improve health and well-being. The cool thing about integrative medicine is that it's interdisciplinary, just like our team at CYW. There are lots of different ways to combat toxic stress. If you hate yoga and rock climbing, you might be into running or swimming. That's fine, as long as you're doing some kind of regular exercise for about an hour a day. That's what matters. Likewise, there are lots of types of mental health interventions that work. But the most important thing is to make sure that they're trauma-focused. Ideally, you want to maximize all six of those things, especially for adults, because our brains aren't as plastic as they were when we were kids. But the general idea is, the more of the six things you do, the more you'll reduce your stress hormones, reduce inflammation, enhance neuroplasticity, and delay cellular aging. Of course, it's also a good idea to cut out stuff that accelerates inflammation and cellular aging, like cigarettes, and to minimize neurotoxins like alcohol, I said, tapping my wine glass. All the fun stuff is what Josh would say, said Janet, smiling. Well, when you tell him that if he cuts down on the beer, he can ramp up the intimacy, he might not mind as much, I said. Does that fall under the exercise category? Asked Janet. I laughed. There's that, but it has more to do with the healthy relationship piece of things. Sometimes I think folks out there are waiting for a fancy pill to show up, and they're missing the point that we, as humans, have a profound power to heal ourselves and one another. Look, the research defines toxic stress in children as long-term changes to brains and bodies in the absence of a buffering caregiver. So think about the flip side of that for us adults. We can damage each other's health by repeatedly activating the stress response. But we also have the power to heal ourselves and others biologically. Let me give you an example. Any of y'all get the drug Pitocin when you were having your babies? Heads nod. Well, that same drug, oxytocin, is actually naturally produced by our bodies. It's released in huge amounts during childbirth, and it not only helps the uterus contract to push the baby out, it's also this incredibly powerful bonding hormone. So when your baby comes out, you've never seen anything so beautiful in your entire life. And you would take a bullet for this little cutie. And oxytocin isn't released only during childbirth. It's also released during sex and with hugs and snuggles and healthy relationships. And it buffers the stress response by actually inhibiting the HPA axis, the brain and body's stress response circuitry. Plus, it's been shown to have antidepressant effects. We literally have the capacity to change our own and one another's biology. We don't need to wait for a pill. I honestly believe that right now we have some very powerful tools to interrupt the intergenerational cycle of ACEs.
Do you think your ex-husband had ACEs, Caroline? Asked Kathleen.
Absolutely. She went on to tell us that Nick grew up in a well-to-do suburb in Connecticut. His father was a doctor, and his mother was a respected engineer. But Nick's household was less like the Huxtables he grew up watching on TV, and more like a scene from Whitney Houston and Bobby Brown's short-lived reality show. Nick's dad had a pretty significant problem with cocaine and marijuana. Then Nick's parents divorced when he was 10, and he endured a series of stepmoms, each with a progressively escalating coke habit. For the most part, Nick's dad was able to fly under the radar, functioning as a physician for years, without any major incidents. Home, however, was something else entirely. Nick's dad and his various stepmoms would get into heated, drug-fueled altercations. Nick always used the same word when he described his dad's house. Crazy. Oh my goodness, that's so sad, I said. The thing about it that breaks my heart is that we know that most ACEs are handed down from generation to generation. If Nick had figured out that what he experienced was ACEs and that he probably had a dysregulated stress response that he needed to deal with, can you imagine how differently things could have turned out for you and for Carl? It is ridiculous that everyone does not know this. How do we get people to pay attention to this as something that affects someone they love, whether they know it or not? Asked Janet. That's what you're supposed to tell me. Well, for starters, I think Caroline should call up Time magazine and tell them they've got their next cover story, said Kathleen. After that, everyone started talking at once. The conversation leaped from what everyone's version of normal was in her own childhood to ideas about how to change the status quo by improving awareness and education about ACEs. The night was a total success, but not necessarily because I had gotten some practical get-the-word-out strategies, though I definitely did. The evening showed me the power of the ACE framework to open a dialogue about topics that feel largely taboo in our society. I knew statistically that it was likely that I was surrounded by people with ACEs, but I had never had such an open conversation about ACEs outside of the Bayview Clinic until that night. I've often remarked, only half joking, that the biggest difference between Bayview and Pacific Heights is that in Bayview, people actually know who the molesting uncle is. And it's not because the 94115 zip code has a magical force field that excludes anyone who might somehow harm a child or who's experiencing substance dependence or mental illness. These things just aren't talked about. When I later asked Caroline why she thought there was so much secrecy in upper-income circles, she responded that she believed it was because the risk to reputation was so high. We're expected to be perfect. We're supposed to have it all together. The hiding is pervasive because exposure can cost people their careers. By the mere fact that we are hiding it, we are perpetuating it. After that dinner, it became clear to me that those hidden ACEs were hindering not only people experiencing them, but also the movement that CYW was trying to catalyze by perpetuating the myth that adversity is a problem only for certain communities. Caroline's bravery in sharing her story moved me to my core. ACEs and toxic stress thrive on secrecy and shame, both at the individual level and at the societal level. We can't treat what we refuse to see. By screening for ACEs, doctors are acknowledging that they exist. By being open about ACEs with friends and family, people are normalizing adversity as part of the human story and toxic stress as part of our biology that we can do something about.
Toxic stress is a result of the disruption to the stress response. This is a fundamental biological mechanism, not a money problem, or a neighborhood problem, or a character problem. That means we can look at one another differently. We can start to see one another as human beings with different experiences that have triggered the same physiological response. We can leave the blame and shame out of it and just tackle the problem the same way we would treat any other health condition. We can see this problem for what it really is, a public health crisis that's as indiscriminate as influenza or Zika. I closed the door after my last guest left and sat down at the table where we had all been gathered moments before. I realized that something important had just taken place. After years as an unwitting detective in Bayview and Pack Heights and a bunch of places in between, I had finally figured out what I needed to do to create a sea change in the fight against ACEs and toxic stress. I had inspected all the wells in all the towns and discovered that not only were they deeper than I had ever imagined, but more importantly, they were all connected. Part 4. Revolution. Chapter 11. The Rising Tide. The dinner with Caroline seemed to jumpstart a surreally good streak for my Shout It From the Rooftops campaign regarding ACE impacts and treatments. The American Academy of Pediatrics invited me to keynote their first ever national conference on toxic stress, and I was even invited to the White House to give a briefing for the leaders of 8 White House agencies. It was a serious, pinch-me-I-can't-believe-this-is-happening moment. And I wasn't the only one talking about ACEs. More and more, I was hearing leading voices calling out the need to identify and address the impacts of toxic stress. When I had the opportunity to visit the National Institutes of Health, Dr. Alan Guttmacher, head of the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development, mentioned that he had actually seen my TED Talk and shared with me his belief that the developmental origins of disease are the future of medicine. This resulted in the rarest of responses from me, utter speechlessness. How ACEs affect biology was suddenly a topic for discussion, even in circles where those conversations hadn't previously been happening. So when I began my talk on the need for ACE screening at a New York City conference in the summer of 2016, I was certain that the cross-sector group of scientists, activists, educators, and policy wonks would be the perfect partners for thought-storming ways to make universal screening for ACEs a reality for all children. The one difficulty was that since I'd recently given birth to my youngest son, my body had become the milky equivalent of Old Faithful. There had been a whole day's worth of talks after mine that I couldn't tear myself away from. So by the time the moderator kicked off the closing discussions, I was a hurting mama. I had to sprint to the lactation room to pump. Nearly an hour had passed before I finally returned with 7 ounces of liquid gold for Gray, or Graybu, as I had taken to calling him as soon as we met. I'd been hoping to catch at least some of the wrap-up Q&A, but the woman before me in the lactation room had taken her sweet time. As I scooted into the back of the conference room, squeezing between chairs and whispering excuse me's, I picked up on a weird vibe. The air was thick with the feeling you get when something has gone sideways, and I had a sinking feeling that it might have something to do with me. I'd come in at the tail end of someone's comment and registered only the tone, which was decidedly tense. After that, the conference organizer got up, thanked everyone, and closed out the day. What the heck did I miss? I packed up my things and was making my way to the wine and cheese portion of the agenda when I was stopped by Jeanette Pye Espinosa. Though petite in stature, Jeanette is a big presence. Growing up in Kansas City as the daughter of South Korean immigrants, she has the confidence of someone who has survived her fair share of storms, and as a result, knows how to navigate the world better than most. She had walked up to me with an expression on her face that said, "Don't worry, girlfriend. I've got your back." Although we had never met, I knew Jeanette by reputation. She was the president of the National Crittenden Foundation, an organization that works in 31 states and the District of Columbia to support the self-empowerment of young women and girls. The National Crittenden Foundation had landed on my radar because they had adopted a mandate to address the root causes of poor outcomes for girls, and in doing so, put ACEs at the core of their work. I had heard that the foundation's ACE-informed approach to breaking the intergenerational cycles of poverty, poor outcomes, and violence was yielding powerful results. Jeanette was a fellow foot soldier who had witnessed, day in and day out, the true impact of childhood adversity. Jeanette skipped the handshake and wrapped me in a hug. "Well, that was interesting," she said as she stepped back. "I just got back from pumping. What the heck happened?" I asked. "People are upset. There's a big conversation about why it's dangerous to screen for ACEs, because it'll be used to label low-income children of color as brain-damaged," Jeanette replied, shaking her head. "Which is nuts, because none of the folks who were actually raising these concerns are actually screening for ACEs." What the heck? I was crestfallen. Did they not hear me say that this happens in every community? This is about basic biology. "There's a lot of misunderstanding," came a voice behind us. I turned around and recognized Nancy Mannix, the chair of a foundation taking on ACEs in Alberta, Canada. Nancy had every bit the look of a foundation patron, wearing a gorgeously tailored cream-colored suit and rocking a dark brown bob that reminded me of Jackie O. Earlier in the day, I had heard Nancy stand up and share her experience with bringing the brain science and ACE screening to decision makers and practitioners across the province. Listening to Nancy, I had been seriously impressed by her insights on the ground game. It was clear that she wasn't afraid to roll up her sleeves and get her hands dirty. I had made a mental note to connect with her, so I was thrilled when she approached Jeanette and me. We saw the same thing when we were bringing ACE screening to Alberta. The greatest pushback comes from folks who don't know the science and aren't doing it. "I've never heard someone say, 'I tried screening, but it didn't work,' or 'We had to stop.'" It took only a few minutes for Nancy and Jeanette to fill me in. It turns out that as part of the summary of the day's talks, my call for universal ACE screening came up and was met with some pretty fierce criticism once the floor was opened up for comment. The most passionate resistance came from a few people who felt I was medicalizing adversity when they, as community activists, had spent a long time trying to solve the inequities giving rise to it. The loaded term, biological determinism, was even thrown out there. These criticisms stung for a couple of reasons, but primarily due to the fact that I had spent my entire career working shoulder to shoulder with community partners to improve the health of vulnerable children. That's what had driven me to understand ACEs and toxic stress
in the first place. Somehow, all of that was missed, and I was being painted as that doctor from San Francisco telling us that our kids are brain damaged. I felt as confused and disoriented as I had when I first heard Sister J warn about the toxic dust at our site. I get the concern about labeling, trust me, but it's just not the reality, Jeanette said. She had first-hand experience of what could happen when ACE screening was deployed on a large scale. Across the diverse agencies supported by Crittenton, whether it was a child welfare agency or a juvenile justice organization or a group serving young moms or sex trafficking survivors, Jeanette had seen that the information about ACEs empowered and truly transformed young women. It didn't label them. She told us a story of a recent trip when she was accompanying 18 women and girls from various Crittenton programs located in 18 different states to Washington, D.C., to educate policymakers about ACE screening. As she was presenting the data, Jeanette said, there was a woman sitting right in front of her who lowered her head and began sobbing. Jeanette remembered thinking to herself, this is the one time someone is actually being triggered by this. She had never, ever seen that. She stopped the meeting, told everyone to take a break, and walked over to the young woman and sat down with her. Are you okay? She asked gently. The woman shook her head. Oh no, these are not. I'm not upset. You didn't upset me. Jeanette leaned in, confused. The young woman continued. These are tears of pure, unadulterated joy. Why joy? Jeanette asked. Because I understand now why I am this way. I understand why my siblings are this way. I understand why my mother raised us the way she did. I understand that I can break this cycle for my children, and I understand I am not a victim. I'm a survivor. Since that day, Jeanette told us, this young woman had begun reading everything she could on ACEs and toxic stress. And though she knew it would be a long struggle, she said, I understand that I got here, that my family got here, over generations. And it will take a while to fully process all that. But I know that I can make better choices. And not just for me. I can stop my children from having a score of 8 or 9 or 10. The young woman had scored 10 out of 10 on the ACE screen. Over the years, the National Crittenton Foundation has found ACE scores to be one of their biggest tools for self-empowerment and advocacy. Once the girls they support have the information, they're able to look at the context of their lives differently. Then they no longer feel like they are to blame, or that they're stupid, or that there's something wrong with them. Once they understand how what happened in the past can affect how they feel in the present, how they see themselves and their healing process changes. They understand that their bodies have experienced a normal reaction to abnormal circumstances across the span of their lives. Many times, they'll call their siblings and say, this is it. This is what's been going on with us. The older girls in the Crittenton programs began talking to the younger girls about ACEs and how they were affected, simply because they wished that someone had told them. As we got deeper into our conversation, Nancy Mannix shared more about her experience in Canada. She had spoken to the criticism concerning over-medicalization. A few people were resistant to the idea that toxic stress was a physiological problem in the first place, suggesting that ACEs and their impacts were simply normal human or cultural problems that had no business being met with a medical diagnosis. So why not leave the learning problems to the teachers and the behavior problems to the therapists? The expressed concern was over-reliance on neuroscience. Nancy's experience in Alberta made her an ardent believer in the